Welcome back. We are your internet historians, and in today's episode, we will be discussing the history behind the movie Hidden Figures. And Alec is with us today.
Welcome back, Alec.
Thank you.
How's moving?
So you have all your stuff, but you haven't like officially unpacked, right?
I mean, it's like halfway there. I mean, we're to a working state at this point. Like I'm in my office right now. I have my whole office set up. Like we live literally around the corner from IKEA. So the first week we were here, we were at IKEA like twice a day, every day. It's very dangerous.
Yeah, it is very dangerous. I was just going to say, okay, as I'm drinking this, I'm like, this is... It's a Modelo. It's a reserve because they finished it on aged wood from tequila barrels. And it sucks. I freaking finished it.
What does that mean?
It's probably at the end of the brewing period. They put it in a tequila barrel, I guess. Oh. I don't know. I don't know how beer making works. And I hate it, but I'm chugging it because I already bought a 6-pack. And that was what I wanted to bring up today.
That's sad, guys. It sounded kind of good when you first described it.
I know, it does sound good. And then Luis was like, oh, look at the packaging, it has this like blue color. And I'm like, no, it's hella cute.
I like the blue. Different tasting than the regular Modelo.
It tastes like perfume.
Ew.
Yeah, so it's got that like perfume type of aftertaste, so it's not great. So I have two. I'm almost done with this, and I have this one.
Are those the last ones out of the pack or something?
No, I have one more left. And then I have nuts as my chaser.
Not bad. Gosh.
Yes. Yes, it is. I was like, I have a lot of opinions on beers. And my fridge has become like my little like testing area, because actually what used to happen when we used to work in an office is that I would buy, well, I used to work as like the person who buys like the stuff that goes into the fridge, including beer. And so whenever I got to choose.
Is that beer at work?
Hell yeah, dude.
That's like the hip thing to have.
This is why I specifically chose to work for a tech company. Okay.
I guess it makes sense.
I've office jobs I've always had, like they've never had an issue with like drinking at work.
And can you just freely go into the refrigerator and just grab a beer at any time of the day?
Yeah, dude. I mean, obviously if it's like 10 in the morning where you're going to get some side eyes, but like, no one's going to say anything to you. You know what I mean? You could be like, oh, I'm jet lag, I'm on European time or some stupid shit. But, but anyways, yeah. So I would buy like whatever beer so I could test it out. And now we don't have that option. So I've been buying with my own money, and now I have to pay for it for times like this.
And then it turns out to be a bad choice. And then you're just sad about it.
Yeah. Well, I try really hard to like make sure I buy something that I would prefer to drink, you know, even if it sucked. But this is the first time it's gotten this bad.
We have so much beer and like one of those Trulies or whatever in our fridge, but we like never drink them really. It's just when like people come over and they always leave their freaking alcohol here. And
I hate that.
So we just have like hella shit.
I love that.
I mean, it's kind of nice, but it's like, it's not like it's anything good. Like,
yeah, that's what I hate about it. Luis has this friend and he always brings beer over, and it's like 90% of the time it's awful, and then he leaves it in there, and I like literally he left it in our fridge in San Francisco. We brought it back and gave it back to him when he came over. I was like, take this back.
That's how you do that. Maybe then he'll learn. It's just like, you need to have a better taste in beer or don't come over to my house.
Well, he can come over, just don't bring the beer.
Or take it with you when you leave.
I know. Well, I guess he's like done it like twice. And I think like Luis and I just like, you know, we'll just chug it one day so we can just get rid of it. Actually, you know what is a good use of beer is, oh, I don't know if you could do this with Trulies, but like apparently you can use it for your grass. So yeah, you can like water down the beer a little bit and put it in your grass, and it's supposed to help, because I think the sugars in the beer kind of help the grass go green. I don't know, but that's what I've been doing whenever I've had shitty beer in my house. So actually I should have done that with this.
Have you seen results yet?
I can't tell. I forget where I put it.
Well, you need to do like to... a
put over my entire lawn. So I'm like, the other day I put it in and I was like, so did I put it there or did I put it there?
So you gotta stick like popsicle sticks in the ground or something and do a test. You have like a control and you know.
Either way, it's gone. So, and it doesn't look like the grass has gotten worse.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was like, it's not killing it.
And I think beer is supposed to help with slugs. Like, so if you have a garden, you could put beer in like a bowl and the slugs will go into the bowl versus your garden.
Let me read the synopsis here. Three brilliant African-American women at NASA, Katherine Johnson, Dorothy Vaughan, and Mary Jackson, serve as the brains behind one of the greatest operations in history, the launch of astronaut John Glenn into orbit. A stunning achievement that restored the nation's confidence, turned around the space race, and galvanized the world. Also, I mean, it wasn't Katherine Johnson the only one that actually did the stuff for John Glenn?
Because Dorothy helped with the IBM machines, right?
Yeah,
I guess that's true. I just wanted to say, actually, when I tried to watch this movie, I tried to sign in with your account, Alec, and then it said, oh, we have to verify your identity. So they sent you an email, and I was like, Alec's too busy for me to bug her. So
was it you?
It was me.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So I've been, sorry, side note, side tangent. His JC's mom, John's mom.
Oh, John.
My husband's mom, my mother-in-law, has been calling us like, oh, the Disney Plus logged me out. Like, can I get your login? Blah, blah, blah. Because she has a daycare. So she needs the Disney Plus for the kids. And we're kind of just like, oh, putting it off or whatever until like I needed it. I'm like, okay. And actually she had like called me like right that moment when I was trying to figure it out. So I'm like, well, that's a coincidence. So we got it all sorted out, but we were so confused because we're like, how did we all get signed out? Like, how did the password get? So it all makes sense now. Lisa was trying to get into it. JC's mom was trying to get into it.
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, I feel like that always happens with every subscription service. So when that happened, I was like, I'm not gonna bug her. I can figure this out.
It's all good.
I have an alternative. There are alternatives.
Like, yeah, I'll update the Google Doc with our passwords.
Anyways, besides that, I actually really like the movie. I didn't know it was about NASA. I thought it was another political type of movie.
Seen it before?
No.
I hadn't either.
Oh, really?
It's been on my list for a really long time. I really wanted to watch it and I just like kept putting it off for some reason. And then it was on Disney Plus. I'm like, oh.
Yeah. I feel like I've seen it like three times.
Did you see it when it came out?
I think I did, but not like in theaters. I think I saw it like shortly after like got on to like Netflix or whatever the hell that it was on after. Yeah, but I mean, I like it. It's just, I mean, this time when I was watching it, I wasn't paying like as close attention because I pretty much knew everything that was going to happen. So I was just kind of like casually watching it, but I mean, I still enjoyed it. It's still like, you know, like pretty interesting movie.
I don't know what was going on. I mean, I like space and I like astronomy and stuff like that, but I feel very uneducated when it comes to like the beginnings of like space exploration and stuff. So honestly, I was stressed.
How do they
know?
Well, when they have math and numbers, I'm like, what the?
Well, there's that saying, right? They're like, oh, this isn't rocket science. And like, that's really rocket science.
Yeah.
They say that? I do not remember that line.
No. I meant like as a saying. Whenever something
I thought you
happens.
Said they said that in here. I was like,
No. I just meant it as like when people say that, like, oh, this isn't rocket science. And you're like, okay, watching this movie, you're like, this is.
Well, I mean, they didn't really like go into depth of like explaining anything, which I think is in its benefit because it was more about like the women and like the challenges they faced working in the NASA institution or whatever. So I mean, I think if they went more into like the math and stuff, we'd have been like, you would have lost us. But
they had to like set a boundary otherwise. Yeah, we would have dozed off.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, there was a lot of people in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like when Mahershala Ali showed up, I was like, whoa, Mahershala! Like I tried not to look at the cast this time around because I was just like, oh, we'll just see who shows up.
But yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was waiting for Olivia to or Dorothy, that's her name, right? Dorothy?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
To serve a shit pie.
Oh my God. Oh, but one of my, I guess, favorite scenes was when she, what's her name? Katherine Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
When she was yelling at them after she came back when she was all wet or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh,
I feel like they specifically casted Taraji like for that moment. Cause she's a very, you know, like she can really, I don't know.
Passionate type of. Whatever.
Yeah, she has passion and she can really like capture your attention with that type of passion. So, because
telling JC, I'm like, I've never seen her in such like a quiet.
Me too.
Yeah. Like, she's just so little, but then she's like, I'm going to tell you how it is, dude. Yeah.
Yeah. No, so when she was like yelling, so I was like, I felt that.
Yeah. And the pearls, like, I was like,
well, and then I was just like, kept looking at her lipstick because I'm like, man, she's all wet, and her lipstick and everything is all like perfect on her.
Of course. No mascara running down. Yeah.
And I was just like staring at it.
Katherine Johnson. All right. So we'll go through what happened in the movies, right? Did her parents really move to get her to go to a good school? Like, yes, but it's not exactly how the movie showed it, right? So Katherine lived in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia, and they didn't have a public school for past the eighth grade for the people of color. So in order for her to further her education, her parents had to take their kids to a different county so they can continue to go to school past the eighth grade. Katherine, she enrolled in high school at the age of 10 and graduated by the age of 14. Her family split their time between Institute, West Virginia, where the high school was, and then spent like summers and holidays in White Sulphur Springs. So they kind of moved, but not really. You know what I mean? So it wasn't like a permanent move. They just rented a place in Institute, West Virginia, where they stayed during the school year. So how did she become involved with the space program? So Katherine started to work at the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, which is NACA. I tried to look up if they called it NACA because you know how they call it NASA, right?
Yeah, I was thinking that too. Yeah.
I was calling it NACA in my head when I was reading it.
Yeah, me too. And I tried to like look it up and everywhere was like NACA, NACA. I was like, all right, I'll just say NACA, you know? Okay, we'll call it NACA. Cool. So she started working there in 1953 after a relative told her that they were hiring mathematicians, both men, women, white, and African Americans. So according to an oral history archived by the National Visionary Leadership Project, at first, Katherine worked in a pool of women performing math calculations. Katherine has referred to the women in the pool as virtual computers who wore skirts. Their main job was to read the data from the black boxes of planes and carry out their precise mathematical tasks. Then one day, Katherine was temporarily assigned to help an all-male flight research team. Katherine's knowledge of analytic geometry helped make quick allies with the male bosses and colleagues to the extent that they forgot to return me back to the pool. While the racial and gender barriers were always there, Katherine says she ignored them. Katherine was assertive, asking to be included in editorial meetings where no women had gone before. She simply told the people she had done the work and that she belonged. Simply put, I just wanted to make sure I cut it off. Once she got a taste for the complex math and they got a taste of her, she demanded to get the respect she deserved, which worked out because in 1958, NASA dissolved the pool of computers and brought in actual computers. And Katherine got to advance in her career and became an aerospace technologist.
But I always thought it was interesting in the film how they would always be like, this isn't like designed for a woman or whatever. And I'm like, you guys just talk normal. That's it. You don't have to design or say anything specific to women. Like, it's just, you just talk regular.
Yeah. And I thought it was actually interesting that they played on both racial and gender discrimination in the movie. So they didn't want to just, you know, make it just one thing. Did she have to run around to find the bathroom? So no, she did not.
Yeah, that's what I read, but they said it was more like Mary did it, and there was like a story with it. Like, I guess when she was trying to do her engineering stuff, she asked some ladies like, oh, where's the restroom? And they just laughed at her. And then so she had to go run around looking for one, basically. But
okay. Basically, it wasn't Katherine. Katherine used the white bathrooms. And when someone finally complained, she ignored it and never got in trouble, because in 1958, when NASA took over, they dissolved the segregated bathrooms. But I think I was reading how they were like saying they didn't, like some critics didn't like that they put that in the film because Kevin Costner was the white hero and they didn't like how there was a white hero. It was interesting.
Well, it kind of made it seem like the whole, I mean, I guess it was about racial stuff, but for some reason, like going into this movie, I thought it had to do with bathrooms or something.
Yeah. Like,
because I feel like how they marketed like the trailers and stuff, it was all about like her going, trying to find a bathroom or whatever. And I'm just like, okay, like I get it, but it's like, I don't know. It kind of felt weird a little bit to me to have it in there, at least as heavily in it as it was. Like they constantly were showing her running to the bathroom and trying to, you know, do her calculations while she's on the toilet. And it was just, I don't know. It was a bit much for me personally.
Yeah.
Yeah. So meeting her husband, I put, which one?
Since I just put both because it's pretty short. I mean, you know, most of her work is with NASA, so they didn't have much about her husband, but she met her first husband when she started teaching for a public school after college. He was a chemistry teacher. His name was James Goebel. They were married in 1939 and he passed away in 1956 from an inoperable brain tumor. I know. So they did have those three daughters that they showed in the movie. In 1959, Catherine married James A. Johnson. He had been commissioned in 1951 as a second lieutenant for the United States Army and was a veteran of the Korean War. They were introduced by the minister from their church. So the other thing that I read that was the three daughters were actually like teenagers by the time they got married, not like little kids in the movie. I'm glad she was able to find somebody else. She didn't have to, but it was nice, you know. That was like another thing I was wondering too in the movies. I was like, oh, of course one of these Disney movies has to have some sort of love interest, you know, like why can't we just focus on like what these women do? But you know, I guess it's, I don't know, kind of part of it's not really part,
I don't know, of the story, it was just part sweet of her life. I liked Mahershala's character.
I know, it's like you love him.
How he had to apologize to her because just like, excuse you, she is not like any other woman. Like, come on, you can't be saying these things.
Yeah.
So
I didn't mind it as much. I think it's because I didn't feel like it was like the main focus of the film. So it didn't really bother me. It just kind of was like, oh yeah, this is also happening in her life kind of thing.
So what are her accomplishments? I was like, where do I start? Because I literally filled up like an entire page of everything. So I'll try to make this as quick as possible. She graduated high school at 14. She graduated college at 18. She was the first African-American woman to attend graduate school at West Virginia University. She calculated the trajectory for the May 5th, 1961 space flight of Alan Shepard, the first American in space. She also calculated the launch window for his 1961 Mercury mission. So the scene when NASA used electronic computers for the first time to calculate John Glenn's orbit around the Earth, officials called on Catherine to verify the computer's numbers because Glenn asked her specifically and refused to fly unless Catherine verified the calculations. That is true.
I was gonna say, so that was true. Dang, yeah. That's cool.
Well, also, the thing is, actually, it wasn't that quick. I guess she had a week to verify the numbers.
Mm. Not right when he was about to walk onto the.
No. Yeah, it was
like
not
stressful like that. No. I was just like, oh my God.
Yeah, it's not that intense. Well, I mean, it is intense, but it wasn't like in a couple of hours or minutes as they made it seem. In 1961, Catherine's work helped ensure that Alan Shepard's Freedom 7 Mercury capsule would be found quickly after landing using the accurate trajectory that had been established. She also helped calculate the trajectory for the 1969 Apollo flight to the moon. And then in 1970, Catherine worked on the Apollo 13 moon mission. And when the mission was aborted, her work on backup procedures and charts helped set a safe path for the crew's return to Earth, creating a one-star observation system that would allow astronauts to determine their location with accuracy. Later in her career, Catherine worked in the space shuttle program, the Earth Resources Satellite, and on plans for a mission to Mars. Oh, okay. I'm taking a deep breath. She also co-authored 26 scientific papers. Just some quick honorable mentions, because I just feel like we should say this. But in 1999, she was named West Virginia State's College Outstanding Alumnums of the Year. That sounds weird, alumnums.
But I think alumnus, isn't it?
I'm sorry, alumnus. There's a lot of MNs next to each other. Yeah. President Barack Obama presented her with the Presidential Medal of Freedom, one of 17 Americans so honored, on November 24th, 2015. Two of NASA's facilities were named after her. In 2016, Catherine was included on the BBC's list of 100 women of influence worldwide. In 2018, she was awarded an honorary doctorate by the College of William and Mary. In 2018 as well, West Virginia State University established the STEM scholarship in honor of Catherine and built a life-size statue of her on campus. Mm. Mattel announced a Barbie doll in Catherine's likeness with a NASA identity badge in 2018. 2019, Catherine was announced one of the members of the inaugural class of Government Executives Hall of Fame. There's a lot of things named after her. Mm-hmm. So in 2019, George Mason University named the largest building on their SciTech campus Catherine G. Johnson Hall. In 2020, Bethel School District, Washington names its newest school, the Catherine G. Johnson Elementary. In 2020, a satellite was named after her when it was launched into space in 2021. Northrop Grumman named a Cygnus NG-15 spacecraft to supply the International Space Station, the SS Katherine Johnson, in her honor. In 2021, San Juan Unified School District in Sacramento, California, named its newest school Katherine Johnson Middle School. Woo!
Do you know if her kids were as smart as she was?
I didn't look that up, actually.
I wish I was that smart.
I don't know about her kids, but I think she had some grandkids who went into the STEM, something with STEM, right? Like either science. What does STEM stand for? Science? Technology, engineering, mathematics. Is that a stands for?
Yeah, okay, sounds good.
But yeah, she obviously like just encouraged her kids, grandkids, and great grandkids because she lived until last year. So,
she passed died away. At 101.
Yeah,
wow, 101. Yeah, she died in 2020.
Mm-hmm. What? Where was I?
Sitting or oh know, we're all sitting like around at home.
I know, I feel like I didn't freaking hear about it, like, not that I really knew who she was, but I feel like I would remember someone that prolific to NASA dying, but I don't, I mean, I guess COVID just ruins everything.
I also have a fun fact. So when Katherine graduated from college, not only did she receive degrees in math, but she also received one in French because she started learning French when she was in high school because she would work at a resort during the holidays aiding a Parisian chef. So that's
it. I just wish I was like
had a brain like her,
innately, yeah, like smart like that. Like, oh my god, I couldn't even imagine
how she makes you feel super dumb. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, if she was 10 years old freaking doing all this shit, or you're like going into high school or whatever, and it's just like, what? I'm over here just like playing Barbies and shit or something.
So you and I are trying to read again.
Yes.
Kind of interesting that this movie was based off of the book and both of them came out the same year. The movie is like based off of early iterations of the book, so
I know, that's I saw why, that
some stuff was kind of different. Made there's some stuff bit. yeah
because exactly. Even like researching some of the stuff, I'm like, okay, like this, what I'm writing down is definitely seems like it's like fragments of what they might have had information on these women, and then they elaborated a lot on it, you know, in the movie, obviously.
Going back earlier when you were talking about if her kids or whatever, I was going to say that one of Dorothy's kids, I believe, is one of her sons, because she had 6 kids, did go on to work for NASA, which I thought was kind of cool. So maybe, you know, their smartness runs in the family.
Yeah, I was like, dang, I want to get any genes like that.
Well, also they live around that area, right? So maybe it just helps, like just like how I'm in tech, right? Because I live near, well, I did live in like San Francisco, right? So you're like, oh, tech's everywhere. So you go to tech.
You know who also lives around that area and isn't smart? Me. It was kind of funny because we started this movie and it was like Hampton, Virginia. I was like, wait a second, are they at Langley? So Hampton, Virginia is like 20 minutes north of me at my new house that I moved to. I live in Norfolk now, Newport News, and then Hampton and then Langley is up here. So I could go up there to NASA if I wanted to. I think
you know what I looked up?
Visitor center and stuff.
I looked up if you were also close to where Richard and Mildred were at, because they were also in Virginia. They were in, what is it?
I'm like, I could work at NASA. I could be the janitor.
Here, this waste basket wasn't emptied last night. Like in the movie, oh God.
I know, that was cringe, right?
Let's talk about Dorothy Vaughn, who was played by Octavia Spencer in the movie. So Dorothy Vaughn was born September 20th, 1910. Same girl, same.
I know. Alec, is that you? Yeah.
In Kansas City, Missouri, as Dorothy Jean Johnson. At the age of 7, her family moved to Morgantown, West Virginia, where she graduated from Beechhurst High School in 1925 as her class valedictorian. Vaughn received a full tuition scholarship from West Virginia Conference of the AME Sunday School Convention to attend Wilberforce University in Wilberforce, Ohio. She joined the Alpha Kappa Alpha chapter of Wilberforce and graduated in 1929 with a BA in mathematics. In 1932, she married Howard Vaughn, who died in 1955. I think they showed her husband like a tiny, tiny bit.
Yeah, when they were dancing. I remember the dancing scene.
The couple moved to Newport News, Virginia, where they had 6 children. The family also lived with Howard's wealthy and respected parents and grandparents on South Main Street in Newport News, Virginia. Vaughn was very devoted to family and the church, which would play a huge factor in whether she would move to Hampton, Virginia to work for NASA. So how close is it to my family? Then I'll think about it. Then I'll think about being really, really smart. All right, so a lot of my stuff I got from the NASA website and Wikipedia. What I got on her from the NASA website was actually written by the author of the book. So I thought that was kind of cool. In 1941, President Franklin D. Roosevelt issued Executive Order 8802 to desegregate the defense industry and Executive Order 9346 to end racial segregation and discrimination in hiring and promotion among federal agencies and defense contractors. These helped ensure that the war effort drew from all American society after the United States entered World War II in 1942. With the enactment of the 2 executive orders and with many men being swept into service, federal agencies such as the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, NACA, also expanded their hiring and increased recruiting of women, including women of color, to support the war production of airplanes. 2 years following the issuance of the executive orders, the Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory, or Langley Research Center, the NACA facility, began hiring more Black women to meet the drastic increase in demand for processing aeronautical research data. The U.S. believed that the war was going to be won in the air. It had already ramped up airplane production, creating a great demand for engineers, mathematicians, craftsmen, and skilled tradesmen. Dorothy Vaughn came to the Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory in 1943 during the height of the war, leaving her position as a math teacher at Robert Russell Moton High School in Farmville, Virginia, to take what she believed would be a temporary war job. Dorothy was assigned to the segregated West Area Computing Unit, as we see in the movie, an all-Black group of female mathematicians who were originally required to use separate dining and bathroom facilities, also seen in the movie. Over time, both individually and as a group, the West computers distinguished themselves with contributions to virtually every area of research at Langley. It's so weird to think about them being called computers and then like what we know as computers, because when you think about it, computers is a verb. So it's kind of like, but it's also a noun. So it's just
it's not a noun.
Yeah. But I mean, it's like, as we know, computers, it's a thing, but they were computers. Like they were computing things. It's just like weird to think of it coming from that term. The group's original section heads, which I think she mentioned this Blanche Sponsler person. She was sick, so she like took over her role. So their original sponsors were white, or sorry, their sponsors, the original section heads were white. In 1949, Dorothy was promoted to lead the group, making her the NACA's first Black supervisor and one of NACA's few female supervisors. The section head title gave Dorothy rare laboratory-wide visibility, and she collaborated with other well-known and white computers like Vera Huckel and Sarah Bullock on projects such as compiling a handbook for algebraic methods for calculating machines. Vaughn was a steadfast advocate for the women of West computing and even intervened on behalf of white computers and other groups who deserve promotions or pay raises. Which did you guys, I freaking died at that scene in the bathroom where she's talking to Kirsten Dunst, and Kirsten Dunst is like, oh, well, I'm going to bring some of my girls over to talk to you. And Octavia Spencer is just like, I don't know, I think you'd have to talk to the supervisor about that. That's out of my hands. I was just like, oh, got him. I thought that was so freaking funny.
She's like, oh, now that you needed someone to help you guys save your jobs, you want to come on over here.
Yep. Engineers valued her recommendations as to the best girls, quote unquote, for a particular project, and for challenging assignments, they often requested that she personally handle the work for them. Dorothy helmed West Computing for nearly a decade. In 1958, when the NACA made the transition to NASA, segregated facilities, including the West Computing office, were abolished. Dorothy and many of the former West computers joined the new Analysis and Computation Division, or ACD, a racially and gender integrated group on the frontier of electronic computing. Dorothy became an expert Fortran programmer, which, have you guys ever heard of that? I've never even like heard of that type of like programming or like coating, I guess. I don't know. It's kind of interesting.
You really think I would have heard of something like that?
I don't know. I feel like I would have. I don't know. And she also contributed to the Scout Launch Vehicle Program. So we kind of see that at the end there, how diverse, because then she finally does bring in some of Kirsten's girls.
So know, like when she's learning the IBM stuff or whatever. Mm-hmm. So those are just actual computers, right? That they're just learning mm-hmm. how to like handle, basically. And like, because I was like, what? I don't get what the point of those girls,
no, they're like legitimate ladies. Computers. Yeah.
Yeah. Like their job is just to input information into the computers then, basically. Like, so they're like data people or something, like,
yeah, like data entry.
Yeah. Pretty much. Oh, okay. Yeah.
So I was like, I don't get why they need people to do that. But I mean, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Cause I kind of think that when she was talking to whatever Kevin Costner's character was, the main guy.
Al Harrison.
Yeah, I know, I was sorry. Like, it's Al, yes, something.
Sorry, Al. Yeah, because when she was talking to Al and they were talking about, oh, well, you know, that equation or that, you know, method or whatever hasn't even been invented yet, type of a thing. So I kind of think it's like that, where it's when they're coming up with new methods or new equations to get the information that they need, they're like programming that into the computer so the computer can run the numbers. Cause I mean, they still have, you know, the known numbers. It's like, here's the weight that we know, here's the distance that we know, but we need to figure out where exactly. So it'll just run the equation for them, I'm assuming, is what they're doing. So, but I mean, it's a computer, so it still has to learn. And it seemed like it was,
they were basically there to teach the computer.
Yeah. Teach the computer everything they needed to do. Yeah. Which was, damn, a that lot. Sucks.
They were basically teaching the computer to take over all their jobs then, eventually, at some point. I mean, I guess by that point they'll be gone, but still.
Yeah, probably. But I know, I thought it was kind of funny, just like, I just love when period movies, they kind of like do like a nod and a wink to something. And so like when they first brought in, and they're like, what is this called? IBM.
Oh yeah.
It's just so funny. Oh, it's just like, yes. Dorothy wanted to continue at another management position at NASA, but never received an offer. She retired from NASA in 1971 at the age of 61. In her final years, Vaughn worked with mathematicians Katherine G. Johnson and Mary Jackson on astronaut John Glenn's launch into orbit. She died on November 10th, 2008, and was 98. These ladies, they live forever. Long good time. For them.
Probably because they're so smart and so their minds are like very...
Yeah, they just kept going. And in 2019, Vaughn was awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. Also in 2019, the Vaughn Crater on the far side of the moon was named in her honor.
Wow.
I know. On November 6, 2020, a satellite named after her, Dorothy, was launched into space. So she also got a satellite. Nice. And a crater. So unfortunately, I mean, all of that was after she passed away, which is a bummer, but.
I was saying, is it because like, that's when they realized how like important she was to them? I mean.
Probably.
Because I feel like they weren't like that well known, obviously, during their time there at every, I think it was like after the fact.
I was going to say most of like Catherine's stuff happened after the movie came out. So.
I feel like that happens a lot where they kind of like go back and they're like, oh wait, this person was like integral to, you know. The future.
Everything we were doing,
you're like, I had no idea until the movie came out. I'm like,
oh wait, let's go find this person. Oh, but they died 10 years ago. Darn.
I did see something online that they were saying, I don't know if it was one of the ladies who watched the movie that, you know, Hidden Figures was based off of, but they were saying that, I don't know if it was one of them or who said it, but they were saying like, oh, like from watching this film, you might think that these were like the only people working on it, but in reality it was like teams and teams. Okay, yeah, I was like, in reality, it was like teams and teams and teams of people. So it wasn't really any one person doing more than, I guess, the other. They were all working together. So
they were saying this like, well, I understand that you can't have a movie about like 300 people.
Yeah, exactly.
I had an interview with Catherine. And
you did? What did she say?
Well, I had yeah.
How did you talk to her?
sorry. It was it looks like it was a radio interview with Catherine.
And then, with the Ouija board?
No. So no, this all his info came out around when the movie came out in 2016. You know, he gotta hype up the movie. And then I also had a quote from the author of the book. Oh, her name is Margot Lee Shetterly, by the way. And the book is also called Hidden Figures, just on what segregation and racism was like at NASA. So Catherine says, I didn't feel the segregation at NASA because everybody there was doing research. You had a mission and you worked on it, and it was important to you to do your job and play bridge at lunch. I didn't feel any segregation. I knew it was there, but I didn't feel it. Even though much of the racism coming from Catherine's coworkers in the movie seems to be largely made up, in real life she claimed to be treated as a peer. The movie's depiction of state laws regarding the use of separate bathrooms, buses, etc. was very real. African American computers had also been put in the segregated West section of the Langley campus and were dubbed the West computers. Which I feel like, I mean, she does among the other men in the office, but I feel like her boss Al, I feel like, which I was kind of describing him to JC, because JC was like coming and going while I was watching the movie, I'm like, no, he was very much a like get the job done kind of guy, which kind of seemed like, as she was describing it, it's like you do your job and no one cares, you know, if you're a woman or, you know, what mm-hmm. your race is or whatever. It's just like, just do your job, we're all here to, you know, do your job.
But it's funny when Catherine says that, because I saw that too, and Catherine said she didn't really feel it. It's like, but you had to like demand to be in that meeting.
Yeah.
You know, because they were trying to tell her, oh, you're a woman, so you're not allowed. And then she said, well, is that the law? And then they said no. So she like ended up going in. So I think like maybe bigger, other than that, I guess she didn't feel it, but it clearly isn't like not there, right?
Yeah, I think there, it just wasn't as heavily as it was in the film. I think there was obviously segregation and all that stuff, and we're like racial, what is it, tension, but I don't think it was as intense as it was portrayed in the film,
because they had bigger things to worry about, you know, right?
So. Yeah, and I feel like Jim Parsons' character, like when they were having that conversation, I feel like he was kind of supposed to be the representation or like the stand-in of just like the old way of thinking type of a thing, because she's like, well, where does it say that? Like, where can't I? He's just like, well, that's just the way it's always been done, you know, and there's mm-hmm. always people that are like, don't change it if it's not broken or whatever. don't fix it if it's not broken type of a thing. Like, I feel like that's what like his representation of a character was supposed to be.
Mad when he didn't want to give her credit for like some of the stuff she was working on. I don't think that was real, but I was like, oh hell no. And then when she like typed her name on, I was like, yeah, you typed your name on that paper. Yeah. You're the one who came up with that shit.
So I had this little blurb from Margot Shetterly. She wrote about a cardboard sign on one of the tables in the back of NASA's Langley cafeteria during the early 1940s that read colored computers. This particularly struck a nerve with the women because it seemed especially ridiculous and demeaning in a place where research and intellectual ability was focused on much more than skin color. It was Miriam Mann, a member of the West Computers, who finally decided to remove the sign. And when an unknown hand would make a new sign a few days later, Miriam would shove that sign into her purse too. Eventually, the sign stopped reappearing at some point during the war. There are bigger things going on, people. It's like, really need to label everything. Get over yourselves.
Yeah, I think a place like NASA, you know, they are worried about bigger things, right? They're worried about trying to get somebody into like space
keeping them alive.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I was interested in Mary because I liked her sassiness. So I was like, I want to learn more about her. Well, and I thought they were going to have, I don't know, I guess some of the info that I found her was kind of just repeated itself a lot. I don't know if you guys had the same thing. But I feel like every single article I found, they all kind of just said the same exact thing. And it didn't go as in depth as I would have liked. Like, I wanted to know like the details, but I kind of just basically got overviews of everything. And yeah, I also got some of my info off of NASA's website as well. Before Mary landed a job with NASA, or then NACA, she was once a teacher who taught math at a Black school in Calvert County, Maryland, which I feel like Katherine Johnson was also a teacher, right? At one point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Dorothy.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They're all teachers.
They're all teachers.
Because I think that was like probably the easier job for them to get.
Or right? One. Yeah, I'll say one that they were able to get into. So after a year of teaching, she returned home and found a position as the receptionist at the King Street USO Club, which served the city's Black population. She again left this job and worked as a bookkeeper, stay-at-home mom, and an army secretary, not all at the same time, one after the other. And then before she landed her job at Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory Segregated West Area Computing Section in 1951. She reported to the group supervisor, Dorothy Vaughn. After 2 years in the computing pool, Mary received an offer to work for engineer Kazimierz Sarknek, who in the film, they changed it to Carl Zielinski. They worked on basically what they worked on in the film. It was a 4-foot by 4-foot supersonic pressure tunnel, a 60,000 horsepower wind tunnel capable of blasting models with winds approaching twice the speed of sound. So essentially the same thing that we saw in the film them working on.
No shoe was worth your life.
I know. Because Zarnecki offered Mary hands-on experience conducting experiments in the facility and eventually suggested that she enter a training program that would allow her to earn a promotion from mathematician to engineer. Which, again, similar to how it is portrayed in the film. That's why I'm like, I feel like they just took all these little tidbits of facts and then just elaborated on like all the more dramatic stuff that happened in the film. In the film, the classes Mary needed to become an engineer required she take graduate level classes of physics and mathematics. Unfortunately, these classes were held at an all-white high school, so Mary petitioned the city of Hampton to be able to attend the classes. They said yes, and she took the class. I don't know, I was really interested in the scene where she was talking to the judge and, you know, had that whole little spiel, and I really wanted this to be like based on a little bit of fact or something, or that she had some type of conversation like this, but that scene didn't happen.
Right.
But I wish it was, because it was kind of a good scene too.
It was a good one. Yeah.
So she was promoted to aerospace engineer in 1958 and became NASA's first Black female engineer. She worked as an engineer in several NASA divisions. And these are the division names, so it's going to be kind of a mouthful too. The Compressibility Research Division, Full-Scale Research Division, High-Speed Aerodynamics Division, and the Subsonic Transonic Aerodynamics Division. She ultimately authored or co-authored 12 technical papers for NACA and NASA. She worked to help women and other minorities to advance their careers, including advising them how to study in order to qualify for promotions. By 1979, Jackson had achieved the most senior title within the engineering department. She decided to take a demotion in order to serve as an administrator in the Equal Opportunity Specialist field. After undergoing training at NASA headquarters, she returned to Langley. She worked to make changes and highlight women and other minorities who are accomplished in the field. She served as both the Federal Women's Program Manager in the Office of Equal Opportunity Programs and as the Affirmative Action Program Manager. And she worked to influence the career paths of women in science, engineering, and mathematics positions at NASA. And then she worked at NASA until her retirement in 1985. So she did a lot. Okay, so were the ladies BFFs like they were portrayed in the film? No, they were not.
Darn.
That's kind of sad.
I mean,
they did work together, but they weren't like homies like that. They were just like people that you say hi to when you go into work, you know, like you might have a conversation with them every now and then, but you're not going to like barbecues and church events and introducing each other to each other's future husbands type of thing like it was in the film, or they didn't carpool together either.
Because Catherine and Mary were computers at the same time under Dorothy's supervision. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just kind of, because I don't know how many women were in that computer program. I can't remember. So
I don't remember.
Basically, it's just a lot where you're not going to become BFFs with everybody.
And I guess even in the film, the book, she wasn't like writing a story of these ladies that were best friends. It was just kind of just like, these are people that were influential in the NASA during that time or whatever. So I think they just obviously did it for the film to make it, you know, make the ladies, I keep calling the ladies, their stories kind of go overlap each other. Cause they were definitely doing different things in the film too. They weren't like, their career paths didn't like intertwine really, other than the fact that they were all computers.
Yeah, and it kind of made sense to do it that way, because then you could have this movie about all three of them if you just kind of give them a silly relationship that isn't as important, but you can bring them together so you can tell the story about all three of them in one movie.
Yeah, I read that the reason why they did it as well is because whenever they are frustrated, they could voice their frustrations to each other, and we can hear that and like feel that type of frustration emotion.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, and this is really short tidbit of information, but if the men in the film were real, obviously the astronaut dude was real. We don't have to look that up. John Glenn. Actually, I didn't even know his name though before watching this movie. So I
only know Buzz Aldrin.
Yes. And Buzz? What's the other guy's name?
Not even Neil?
Yeah, I was saying Neil Armstrong.
Yeah. But those are the ones that you think about, though, when you like think about NASA and like, it's exactly. Like, oh yeah, the ones that went to the moon. Like,
I know, I feel bad.
That just went into like, orbit. Yeah. Okay.
They overshadow the first men in space, right?
Yeah, they do.
I looked up to see if Al Harrison, who is Catherine's boss, and her like nemesis Paul Stafford were real people. And yeah, so they're not. Al Harrison is not a real person. He is a composite of three different directors at NASA, Langley, and I guess the director wasn't able to like get the movie rights of the person or whatever that he wanted to for the film, so then he just had to create this mega character of Al Harrison, which I was like, that's so weird to have to like get rights to a person. Like, I don't know. I'm like, I mean, I guess it makes sense. Like, you have to make sure that it's okay that you talk about them or whatever and use their likeness in a film. But it was just like, I don't know, weird, just a weird concept to think about. So Paul Stafford, he's another composite character, not a real dude. He wasn't based on anyone at all, though, where like Al Harrison's character kind of was like based like on someone. He just was a completely made up character. And yeah, he was created to like represent the racist and sexist attitudes that existed during the 1950s.
I wanted to know what peeps thought of the movie because, you know, mm-hmm. I always want to know. I looked up some stuff from space.com and a couple of the people that were in it and thought of it. Because, I mean, also, too, I want to know what people at NASA thought of the movie, too. Mm-hmm. So I got that. So.
What about the people at NACA?
Well, Katherine Johnson enjoyed it, right? She said she liked the movie. Mm-hmm.
Yes, according to the author, she saw it and said that she really liked it. And she said, so I think that's pretty much the highest praise you can give when the person whose life is being shown on the screen says, yep, that kind of looks like it. And Johnson herself said that she saw it and enjoyed it. She said it was well done. The three leading ladies did an excellent job portraying us, she told the LA Times. John Glenn died December 8th, 2016. He was 95. These people are living forever, but unfortunately, he didn't get a chance to see it. He died before the movie came out that year. But he was on record for saying that he didn't like the movie The Right Stuff, which is what people, the other space movie that is about him. I haven't seen it. It's compared to this movie, the way that some of the
I want to watch that movie.
Shot. it's like from a different point of view, I guess. But
I feel like John wasn't in this movie very much, so. And the only times he was in it, he was like the good guy.
Yeah, he said that he didn't like The Right Stuff. He didn't think the film accurately reflected the people involved in the Mercury program, including himself.
That one was like complete, like I just read it. It was complete fiction though, right?
I guess.
Like, so, it said it was a fiction
novel or whatever. So I also had some stuff from NASA's chief historian. NASA has a chief historian. But so while
we need to get them on this on our podcast.
Yeah. Oh, I was going to say they should. I think they need some internet historians.
So he says that he enjoyed that movie, but from a history's perspective, it is cringeworthy. He joined the agency in 2001 and wasn't around to advise on The Right Stuff, but he and others at NASA did offer input into the script for Hidden Figures at the invite of the filmmakers. He says they wanted to get the atmosphere of the film correct. Like anything based on real life events, there were some temporal things things that as a historian are like, that didn't really happen like that. But I think that the movie is true to the stories of the main characters. On the whole, I was very happy with the outcome.
That's what I was going to say. It's like, I don't feel like this was necessarily about like space or like the accuracies of what they were doing. It was more of like these women's stories. And they just so happened to be working at NASA and like the things that they're dealing with, you know?
Yeah. Shetterly was still writing her book when production of the film began. It was only just released in September, but she was also available to the filmmakers as they sought to condense a story spanning a few decades into their setting of just a couple of years. She says, for better or for worse, there is history. There's the book and then there's the movie. Timelines had to be conflated and there were composite characters, like Nicole said, and for most people who have seen the movie have already taken that as a literal fact. Which is like, you gotta look into it, you know, you can't just like take it because the movies and read the book, you know,
you gotta listen to our podcast.
Yeah. Bill Berry thought Hidden Figures delivered more truth than fiction, despite the limitations of the medium. He says, on the whole, I'm pleased with the balance of this thing, and I think it does a good job of telling a complex story. The author, Shetterly, also enjoyed the film. She said it embodied the spirit of authenticity. I loved it. I mean, really, honestly, I was crying. I was laughing. I was like, what happens next? Does Glenn make it back home?
That's pretty funny.
I'm glad that they did her book justice and that people at NASA actually like it and were consulted, at least it seems like. So
I feel like you have to if you're making a movie on people and like stuff that's actually happened. You have to at least get a little bit of consultation in there, you know? Thanks for joining us this week on The Internet Historians. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and give us a rating. We would also love to connect with you, so give us a follow on Instagram and subscribe to us on YouTube. Next week, we will be discussing Disney's journey to obtain movie rights to Mary Poppins from the movie Saving Mr. Banks. So don't forget to tune in. Thanks again, and we will see you next week.